The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The declassified report that was released by the CIA, FBI, NSA, they listed seven reasons as to why they felt that Putin hacked the election, why Russia hacked the election. And reason number three was his upset or revenge at what he believed was the American involvement in embarrassing Russia in the doping scandal. Because Gregory had come to the U.S., because the Department of Justice had launched a formal investigation into the Russian doping scandal. Russia or Putin viewed that as basically that America was working to embarrass Russia.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 12th, 2017. The film Icarus by Brian Fogel is a new Netflix documentary about Russian Olympic doping and the defection of the chief scientist at Russia's anti-doping lab, a man named Grigory Rodchenkov. At one level, it's a movie about sports and cheating in them by a state actor. At another level, it's a movie about something that will be very familiar to Lawfare readers and listeners of this podcast, Russian tampering with international processes in order to destroy their integrity. No, the film is not about Russian tampering in the U.S. election, but people interested in that subject will be interested in this film and will see eerie parallels. Director Brian Fogel, who did not know when he started working on this movie that it would be a film about international intrigue, but thought he was doing a film about self-doping, joined me this week to discuss the new release. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 242, Brian Fogel on Icarus. Let's start with the film you thought you were going to make, which is itself an eccentric and interesting project. Walk us through how you got into this.
Well, I got into it creatively. My life has been as a filmmaker. Previous to that, I wrote a play, a book. So the creative pursuit of my life and making film was not new to me. My lifelong passion has been cycling, and I started riding when I was 13 years old. Cycling, I raced for a number of years, and like many people in the world, I was obsessed with Lance Armstrong. And I followed the story closely. And when he confessed in 2013, the biggest thing that struck me was this guy to this day had never failed an anti-doping test. To this day, he had passed 500 some odd tests clean. And the only way they were able to get this guy was through a criminal investigation where his own teammates, who did the same thing as he did, ratted him out in exchange for their own immunity. So I was curious what had failed in the system, because what was being, trumpeted to the media as this huge success for anti-doping and that they had finally essentially got Al Capone, it was essentially like getting Al Capone for tax evasion. And everything that they was supposed to have caught him had failed. And so I got curious about that, and I started talking to all these scientists. And one after another, they essentially told me that the system doesn't work. And then they told me that the science could, you could still evade detection. And I started essentially developing this idea that I wanted to explore the anti-doping system in sport, not just cycling, but in sport, because I'm going, if the most tested athlete on planet Earth has been able to pass through all the tests, what does this mean for all of sport? And in that process, I would turn myself into a guinea pig, dope myself, find somebody to advise me on how to do it, find somebody to test my samples, and in the process of making this film, not only show firsthand what these performance-enhancing drugs do, but also explore whether or not the system to test athletes actually works. And that was the project in the film that I decided to set out to make in 2014.
And to be clear, you did not think at the time that you were making a film about Russia in particular, or about Russian dope spoofing in particular. You were looking at what you could show about what one could get away with in general, right?
Yes. I mean, at the time, I mean, first of all, I could have never imagined where the story was going to go when I started on it. I could have never imagined that Russia would be in the news every day, and the current U.S. administration, or so on and so forth. So the Russia element and how that story developed was not what I set out to make. Yet when the film pivots and it's clear what had happened and who I was dealing with, it also became clear that the story and what was my primary objective in making the film could no longer be what the film was ultimately about.
So one thing that has puzzled me both times I watched this film, and that actually you in the film scratch your head about a little bit, is what the motivation of the person who becomes the main character, Grigory Rodchenkov, is in helping you with this self-doping project to begin with. For listeners who have not seen the film, basically the only scientist that you were able to get to help supervise this self-doping program is this fellow Rodchenkov, who was at the time the head of the Russian anti-doping program. And he, for some reason, allows himself to be a participant in this project. And so my question in retrospect, why did he get involved with you in this film in the first place, in your mind?
Well, you know, I've had this question so many times, and there's a part of the film that we don't see, or really a part of the story that we don't see, and the reason why is because I didn't film it. I met Grigory. I first got into contact with Grigory. It was April 2014, so this was just a month after Sochi. And I'd been in touch through Catlin, and I presented myself just purely, you know, as an American documentary filmmaker looking to do a documentary on the anti-doping system, whether or not it was working, and more specifically on whether or not Armstrong could still get away with the test. So we started emailing quite a bit. That led to phone calls. And then in July 2014, while I was training clean for the first race in Boulder, Colorado, getting ready to go to Europe, he invited me to come and meet him at a symposium in Oregon that he was lecturing at ahead of the Junior World Athletic Championships there that year. And so I go up there and meet him, and rather than bringing my camera or anything like that, I go up there simply to meet him. And we spend 2 days together, and during that time we talk and we bond, and we just immediately just hit it off, and we're friends. And after the first day, I say to him, "Hey, look, here's the film that I want to make, and this is what I want to do. Would you help me?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'll help you." And you know, there was no cameras or anything like that. And I said, look, you know, anything I shoot at the end of the day, when we're done, I want to make sure that, you know, I don't jeopardize you and your work, and, you know, we can discuss it. And with that, we had a handshake. There was never, ever a drop of money ever exchanged between us. And, you know, 6 months later, as I'm about ready to dope and start doping, is the first time that we actually use Skype. And that Skype call, which is in the film, was the very first time that we Skyped together. And I hadn't seen him, you know, at that point for months, but we had kept in touch. And so we had a real kind of friendship and a trust between us. And I think that that is why he initially agreed to help me. And also, you know, he told me many times that he had really had it with the ministry. Sochi broke him because it wasn't about the science. It was just him essentially being part of the fraud. And I think he also sensed that you know, the circle was closing in around him.
At what point did you realize that the story was at least in significant part about him, rather than the story being a story of this undertaking that you were doing with which he was helping you?
You know, that was kind of like a slow process, but it also was, you know, through every single time that we're together, and I see him and he comes to LA and I'm interviewing him, and so many of the interviews that we did together are not in the film. It's becoming clearer and clearer to me that, you know, that this guy has got, you know, an amazing life, an amazing story. So, you know, even before the larger allegations truly become clear, I'm trying to essentially figure out how to integrate his story into the film, because I'm riveted by it. And then, of course, as November 2015 happens in this investigation, and he leaves Russia in fear of his life, and he arrives in Los Angeles. And it was really around that time that you know, I accepted and embraced that it was his story that I needed to tell in this film, and bigger than that, the evidence that he had and what he had been involved with, regardless of the film, was something that had to come public into the world, and he wanted to do that.
From the point of view of the readership of Lawfare, and for that matter, the listenership of the Lawfare podcast, which is not a sports or sports doping audience, the reason this story, at least to me, is fascinating is that it is a story of the use of covert actions to subvert independent processes that are supposed to have integrity. And your original game plan, which was to simply demonstrate by doing it that the systems didn't have integrity, actually gave way to a giant demonstration project at the hands of a state actor that the systems didn't have integrity, or at least to the extent that they had any integrity, it was very manipulable. And you happened to be working with the guy at the center of that set of actions. Now, I'm interested, first of all, in your thoughts generally on, you know, there is this other Russian covert action program directed at the integrity of other foreign processes that are supposed to have integrity, i.e. electoral processes. And I'm interested in your thoughts on the sort of general political ambience in which this movie has made its appearance, and You know, I wrote some thoughts today about how this relates to ongoing news events, but I'm interested in your thoughts about it. Is this an isolated story, or is this, you know, at some level a metaphor for some larger political set of conversations that we're having about the role of Russian active measures?
Oh, well, Ben, you know, in the film, we latch on to 1984, you know, and George Orwell. And essentially, what is the narrative theme of that book, which we bring into the narrative theme of Gregory's life, and then into the larger context, really the theme of what is going on in the current U.S. administration, current global policies, and specifically in regards to how Russia is behaving and has behaved in many fashions. And what we see in this kind of Orwellian thematic narrative that we put forward in the film is mirroring itself in real life. And Gregory goes through these three stages of Winston Smith's reintegration, of learning, understanding, and acceptance. And in acceptance, essentially the totalitarian government, Big Brother, wins, and that the truth is of not consequence. There is essentially A, no punishment for the truth, B, there is denial of the truth, and see, everything goes on as normal. And I think that we're seeing that right now in regards to the media handling of Russia. We're seeing it in regards to what is exposed in the film, which is this spectacular fraud against all of sport for 40 years, and the IOC, the Olympics, essentially, you know, fails to take any punishment or action, and now they're talking about a $50 million fine to allow Russia to be in the Winter Olympics. So again, the Olympics essentially gets another $50 million in their pocket, while every clean athlete in the world has been defrauded, and Russia essentially gets away with it. And then in regards to our political process, what you see in the film is that no matter how much evidence is presented against Russia, no matter what is brought forward, they simply deny. There is no accountability for their actions. There is no apology, or there's no change. And we're seeing the same thing mirror itself in our daily political cycle, where everything that is breaking is essentially is accused of being fake news. No matter how much evidence is brought forward, we're simply having Russia or the current administration deny, and we're seeing everything that happens in Icarus as a film repeat itself in our very political cycle geopolitically, and hits right on the nose as to the extent that Russia is willing to go to subvert and covert and corrupt, democracies, sports organizations, the Olympics, et cetera, to push itself into the global arena. I don't know how you feel about that, but that's certainly how I feel, and I think what the film shows very importantly is beyond a reasonable doubt. It presents the evidence should an American or somebody watch this film and wonder to what extent is Russia willing to go to assert itself into world politics and also obstruct democracies.
So before we get to exploring those parallels a little bit further, I want to pause over the question of why Vladimir Putin cares about sports performance at the level enough to do these things. I mean, I know that, traditionally authoritarian governments whether they be, you know, the Chinese or the Soviets or now the Russians or, for that matter, the Nazis, care a lot about international athletics as a form of national pride. But why is performance at Sochi so important to Putin? Why does he care enough to take the risks associated with this, with these actions?
Well, to me, the answer is obvious. First of all, let's just think about the Olympics as an event. What are the Olympics? The Olympics are every 2 years, all of planet Earth, every country on planet Earth coming together in sport. And just as George Orwell said, sport is war without the weapons. So what the Olympics are is it's China versus America, America versus Russia, France versus Germany, on and on and on. And when these athletes go into the Olympic Games, they're no longer competing as individuals, they are competing as their country. And these Olympic Games, which are watched all over the world, is where people are not only is it nationalistic and a source of pride, it is a place for countries to assert their dominance on the fields of play into world affairs, to show themselves as a powerful country. And also, when you look at the host country of these Olympics, for example, what China did in Beijing and how they orchestrated this flawless Olympics and those opening ceremonies and closing ceremonies, what China was showing the world was how advanced they were, how they were superior, how they could operate economically, militarily, that they were a force to be reckoned with. And that's what we learned out of those Beijing Olympics. And then you look at Sochi. What that money was investing in and what that money was behind was to show the world that Russia was not a second world country, that Russia was a first world country, that they were a global power, that they were beyond just a military nuclear superpower, but that they could pull off these Olympics. They could build, they could create roads, they could construct, and not only that, they could win. So when you look at what that was on a political, a geopolitical level, for the world to see and for Vladimir Putin to show the world how powerful Russia is, what Russia is capable of doing, it makes sense the extent to which he would go to win. I mean, to spend $50 billion to host an Olympic Games, which I think is two or three times the amount of money ever spent on an Olympics before, and to lose, that would look absurd. So it wasn't just to host the games, it was to win. Because if Russia could win at its own Olympics, not only was it national pride, not only did it consolidate his power as a leader, it was showing the entire world how powerful Russia was, how powerful Putin is, and that they are a country politically and economically to be reckoned with. And that's why he did that, and that's why it was so important, because it's so much further beyond just a gold medal. The gold medal is just the icing on the cake. But what it was about was asserting Russia as a geopolitical force into the world and showing the world how powerful they are.
So when you compare that to the presumably more strategic objectives associated with, hacking actions in order to tamper with foreign electoral processes, be they in the United States or in Europe, does that seem, I mean, on the one hand, the objectives are quite different, right? One is presumably to is to make a statement about Russian power. The other, depending on whom you believe, is either to advantage one set of candidates at the expense of another, or merely to sort of sow discord within Western countries and sort of create kind of political chaos. How do you understand the similarities and differences between the Russian objectives and these. I mean, what they have in common is that they both involve these very elaborate, quite risky measures in order to subvert these processes. But do you look at it and assume, well, they're probably doing this in everything that they can kind of cheat in? Or do you say that there's something very particular about these two types of areas that kind of beg for this sort of action?
Well, I think in regards to, let's say, the election hacking, if we single that out, one of the things that kind of was covered up or not covered up or just not really put out in public is, the declassified report that was released by the CIA, FBI, NSA, I believe it was January 7th, they listed seven reasons as to why they felt that Putin hacked the election, why Russia hacked the election. And reason number three was, as they listed, based on their investigation, for what they felt was his upset or revenge at what he believed was the American involvement in embarrassing Russia in the doping scandal, and also what he believed was the American involvement in the leaking of the Panama Papers. And what they meant by that was, because Gregory had come to the U.S., because the Department of Justice and FBI had launched a formal investigation into the Russian doping scandal, because the story was brought forward to the New York Times, an American publication, and because Gregory was being protected by U.S. authorities, Russia or Putin viewed that as basically that America was working, essentially behind the scenes to embarrass Russia. I don't know whether or not that is true, but that is what the FBI, the CIA, and NSA found. And there was also a fortuitous timing. We went to the New York Times story broke May 12th. May 17th, the Justice Department launched and announced their investigation into the doping scandal, which we had brought forward to the New York Times. And almost exactly a month after, apparently, the DNC was hacked. There is a kind of strange timing to those events, but I think when you're looking at a bigger level, is what you're seeing is that the course of business, at least in regards to Russia, is that anything is up for grabs, and however you go about doing that is acceptable as long as you get away with it. And even if you get caught, then you don't accept responsibility for the action either. And we're seeing that in regards to, our election, where there still has been no admission of guilt or responsibility. We're seeing that again in, what's alleged in France and Germany. We're seeing that in, what their course of action has been in Syria. It seems to be, how they go about doing business.
So one big difference between the election hacking operations and the anti-doping subversion operations is that one of them has Grigory Rodchenko and the other does not, right? And so we have somebody who's come forward and talked about what they did and from the inside and his own role in it. And from your account, it sounds like he kind of got involved in your project because he was emotionally exhausted by ongoing participation in this sort of thing. And so my question is, are there Grigory Rodchenkos in these other operational theaters? And, should we expect or hope for somebody to come forward from the inside of the Russian side of the operations and talk about what those operations were, how they did them, and, you know, sort of precisely what they did? Or is that just one of those things that happens, you know, once in a thousand years and you happen to be making a film with the guy when it did?
Well, you know, in regards to Rodchenkov and his and him coming forward with this information and the kind of the spectacularness of the allegations and that also they were, you know, all corroborated and proven true. That was obviously, you know, incredible in the fortuitousness of my relationship with Gregory and that we had trust in each other. But as to, you know, other whistleblowers and what this is, I mean, we are seeing a constant, essentially, you know, let's take, for example, the apparent Trump dossier. Well, there's the ex-British MI6 agent, and then there was his Russian intelligence KGB or FSB counterpart. Well, this was not very widely reported in the media, but that but the Russian counterpart to the Trump dossier is dead. He was found dead in the back of a Lexus somewhere outside of Moscow, I believe two, three months ago, right? So what we're seeing is that anybody that the Russia deems to be a potential enemy of the state, they wind up dead under mysterious circumstances. I mean, we see this with Nikita Kamayev, who was Gregory's kind of partner in the operation. Nikita was running the Russian anti-doping agency that was, you know, clearly just to dope athletes and cover it up, and Gregory's running the lab. And Nikita gets in touch with David Walsh, the Sunday Times journalist, back in February of 2016, telling him that he's going to, you know, essentially would like to meet him, and he's got a story to tell. And within days, Nikita dies at age 52 of a heart attack. There's been apparently 14 deaths in the UK over the last year or two under under, I believe it was a, what was the publication that investigated that? BuzzFeed, that had investigated, you know, this link to all these mysterious deaths in London tied to, you know, enemies of Putin. So I think the question is whether or not there is somebody like Gregory willing to come out and put his life at risk and find a way to tell that story. And clearly what we're seeing is that Russia has been very effective at eliminating its enemies who have information against it.
So just in case our listeners hear this last answer to my question and think you are a stark raving paranoid person, where is Gregory today?
Gregory is in protective custody from the U.S. Department of Justice and the FBI. And the reason why he is in protective custody is they had garnered substantial information that he was under surveillance, that the Department of Justice and FBI viewed that his life was in threat and jeopardy. And so in middle of July of last year, we facilitated him into the protective custody of the U.S. government. And, you know, as you see in the film, there is, and we don't spend a ton of time of it, but I mean, there are some startling things that Russia did. We see that they had hacked or were somehow secretly recording the Skype calls that he was having with his sister while in the United States before he went into protective custody. They were monitoring and doing surveillance on all of his family. They raided his homes. They took their passports. They seized the family's assets. And then I was the subject of multiple television shows and news articles in Russia where they had hacked all of his emails and had all of our email exchanges and all the photos that I had sent back and forth to each other. And they had turned these into various television shows on Russian One, where In one case, I saw myself as a cartoon. In another case, it was an actor playing me. I mean, it was extensive. Long story short is he is in protective custody.
And further long story short, they are not playing with respect to people who they think may have information that would be damaging to actions of the sort that he is describing.
Well, I mean, look at Sergei Slaughter's name, Magnitsky, and what is the current Magnitsky Act, and Bill Browder and his book Red Notice, where he goes into extensive detail as to Russian actions to, you know, not only did they believe that, you know, he was poisoned and killed, but, you know, what was going on behind the scenes. Or, you know, Marcia Gessen's book about the rise of Vladimir Putin and how he essentially took power and you know, all the people that perished along the way. So, I mean, clearly they play by a different set of rules.
So what happens now? The movie ends in a very dark place with respect to them basically having sort of gotten away with it. And I'm curious whether you think at this point that there simply isn't the political will internationally to do anything about it, or whether partly maybe because of the electoral interference, we might see a kind of renewed commitment on the part of other countries and maybe even international organizations to take this sort of behavior more seriously.
I would like to be optimistic, but what we're seeing, and this was, let's just take the quote-unquote doping out of the equation. But let's look at the fraud that is uncovered in this film, and it is a spectacular fraud. It is a jaw-dropping fraud. I mean, not only was for the last 40 years Russia essentially doping all of its athletes under a state-sponsored program to go in and cheat every single clean athlete in the world. At Sochi, what they did was just outright the equivalent of breaking into the bank vault because they owned the bank and swapping, you know, counterfeit money for real money. And you would think that and this was all proven, and you would go, there has to be a punishment for this. There has to be a punishment. And yet what we are seeing is that the Olympics, in their multi-billion dollar operation, and what really the Olympics is, despite the face of the Olympics, which is integrity and truth and clean sport and all these feel-good kind of narratives, at the bottom of the line, what the Olympics is a lot of people getting really, really rich on the Olympics. And here, they are not going to punish Russia. The punishment is what we're being told now is going to be a $50 million fine to Russia. So essentially, what the Olympics is letting the world know is that Russia can simply just bribe their way out of the problem by bribing the Olympics to compete again, yet there's no punishment. So, I mean, it's spectacular. So you go, well, so what is the world doing in regards to this? I mean, every athlete on planet Earth should be jumping up and down and screaming bloody murder right now, but they're not, and it appears that Russia is essentially going to get away with this.
So speaking of punishment and accountability, there is one athlete in your account who clearly doped illegally in the context of an international competition, and that is you. And so my question is, have you heard anything, because it would be the ultimate irony if the athlete who were held accountable for doping in the context of this incredible story were you. And I'm curious whether you've heard anything from any international doping authorities or from the Haute Route folks who run that race about what you did and whether they're okay with it or not.
Well, I didn't win. So perhaps if I won, then maybe there'd be a bigger cry to action. But you know, I didn't win. So in many ways, I guess I look like a failure in the world of what performance enhancing drugs can actually do or do not for you. You know, I haven't heard anything. I can't imagine what sanctions would be taken against me, because I'm not a professional athlete. I'm not licensed. I'm not planning to go do that race again anytime soon. I set out from day one not to cheat. I set out to tell a larger story. I mean, I had a very clear goal in mind when I set out to do this, and I chose to use myself as the guinea pig because I didn't know a better way to tell that story, but also to have commitment to that story. Because when you hire somebody, you bring on an actor or whatever that is, or somebody else, you don't know if they might get cold feet. And I knew with myself, being the filmmaker and being the subject at the time, that the only cold feet would be from me.
Brian Fogel, the film is an incredible piece of work. Thank you so much for making it and for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey folks, the Lawfare Podcast needs your help to break through to new audiences. So tweet us, share us on Facebook. Give us that 5-star rating you've been meaning to give us on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution services you use. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the abroad in an authoritarian state, Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.